Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is historian Charles Freeman. Charles is perhaps best known as a historian of the ancient world and the early centuries of the Christian Church, and it's the latter interest which has inspired his fascinating new book, Holy Bones, Holy Dust, which sets out to show how the relics of the saints and martyrs of the Christian Church, a much neglected topic for historians, shaped the history of medieval Europe. And if that seems to be setting relics' claim rather high, listen to this interview and read Charles's book, and you will see just how many aspects of medieval life the relics of saints and martyrs impinged upon, from the most spiritual and holy to the basely commercial and political. As early as the 5th century, the Bishop of Cyrrhus in Syria was able to say, "The philosophers and orators have fallen into oblivion. The masses do not even know the names of the emperors and their generals. But everyone knows the names of the martyrs better than those of their intimate friends." Accumulating relics meant accumulating status and power. It was also good for cash flow. In a world pervaded by magic, saints and martyrs became the posthumous celebrities of their day, the focus of cults that enjoyed enormous popularity for centuries before the Reformation. So when I met Charles in London recently, I began by asking him if it was reasonable to see relics as an important part of the glue that held medieval society together.
I think so. We've got to remember people couldn't travel very far. Or if they did go on pilgrimage, it was really a big undertaking. I mean, you took 6 months out of your life if you went to Rome. Every church had some kind of relic. I mean, even today, the Catholic Church insists that every altar has some kind of relic. You apparently ring up the Vatican and they send you something if you were getting a new church. But in those days, of course, the relics were much more in display. They were exposed. They had usually their feast day when they were exposed, and the crowds would come. So a number of different levels, they held things together. I mean, they did give a focus to pilgrimage, of course. When you went on the pilgrimage, you would always go and see relics. You wouldn't just go to Rome or Jerusalem for the sake of it, but you would see what was left there. They were community activities, and they brought people together. We have examples from Spain, Compostela, that different national groups would arrive and sing their own songs outside the cathedral. And of course, and the people used to complain, it was rather like sort of a rather wild football crowd. So they gave very much a community sense. It was a miracle center. You hope for miracles. Many of these shrines had a long tradition of healing, of course, and you would arrive in the hope, of course, of getting some kind of healing. So that was an important factor, and that held them together. And it was part of the whole story. The bigger churches would sometimes have a relics which took right, they went right back to Abraham, and they had something of Moses, and they had something of various Old Testament prophets. And then they would, in any luck, have something from the New Testament, perhaps an apostle or two, and if they were very lucky, a splinter from the cross. And then they would go on, and they might have later martyrs as well. So you could almost actually learn the history of Christianity through surveying the different relics. And many people must have, at a purely oral level, have picked up an enormous amount about the Gospels and the Old Testament, even if they couldn't read them.
So when did relic cults start and why? I mean, I realise that's a rather big question, but if you can just sketch out, because they didn't start right at the beginning, as it were. They took a few centuries to get going.
Yes, there's no evidence that anyone in the early centuries took any particular interest in the artefacts which are connected with early Christianity. The very first accounts we get are just after toleration was given by Constantine in 313 is the Edict of Toleration. We find that Helena, the mother of Constantine, was sent off to the Holy Land, some people say as a penance for having got herself involved in getting rid of one of Constantine's children. And she was sent on the penance. Whatever she did, she claimed to have found the true cross and also some nails from the cross. She sent the nails to Constantinople, where her son was just setting up his big city, and he had a diadem on his statue there with two of the nails in. The true cross went round, various bits and pieces started travelling around. And that's sort of the beginning, really, of an interest in relics from the very earliest Christianity. But there was another stream of relics, and that was the martyrs. Because during the persecutions, very often the Roman authorities would try and destroy the bodies of martyrs because they realized from an early date that they became the object of veneration. But with toleration, you could, of course, go and seek out and try and find out bits and pieces which were lurking around and still could come to light. So you get a lot of martyr cults as well. And these become very important. And some of the martyrs become more prominent than others. There was in Milan, the Bishop Ambrose Milan found two martyrs, Gervasius and Protasius, and he made a big thing of those as important martyrs, although we've forgotten about them now. They're still buried in Milan beside Ambrose, but he made a big thing of them. And then great in 415, there was a great Bose discovery of the bones of Stephen, the very first martyr from the Acts of Apostles. And he travelled, bits and pieces of him were all round. We find them in Constantinople, an arm of his. We have a wonderful ivory relief of the arm being brought in to Constantinople in the great procession. And then in North Africa, we know Augustine had some bits of Stephen as well. And he becomes really quite important. He's the first martyr. He's really very important. So these martyr cults go alongside these cults of which deal with the artifacts of the Passion, the Crucifixion. And very soon you get the sandals that Christ was wearing before the Last Supper, and a bit of bread from the Last Supper, and a table from the Last Supper. And you get an enormous build-up over the centuries as all these, every kind of relic you can imagine sort of reappears. Even the wine from the marriage feast of Cana reappears in Orléans, and it becomes a cult in itself.
And as you say, collections would be built up, wouldn't they, from various periods in Christian history, like a whole sort of museum of artifacts.
Well, some of these are quite extraordinary. If you look at Durham, for instance, our great saint was St. Cuthbert from Lindisfarne. And when Cuthbert died, they realised they were on to a very saintly figure, one of the great Anglo-Saxon saints. But the Lindisfarne, the island, was very, very vulnerable to Viking raids. So they had to bring the body inland. And they sort of traipsed it around. And eventually they got to Durham, where there was nothing other than, I suppose, a small settlement of some kind. And the cart which they had the coffin on stopped, and nobody could move it. And they said, well, obviously Cuthbert's decided this is where he's going to stay. So eventually he was buried there, and then eventually the great Norman Cathedral was built. And we have an account of about 1300, where round the shrine of Cuthbert there are 700 listed relics. And very strange ones. I mean, some of them were just sort of objects, that sort of almost seashells people had picked up on the shore. But there was a fragment of Mary Magdalene's, robe, and there was the stone in which Jesus' head had laid in the sepulchre, and 700 altogether, individually listed. So when you went into these churches, I mean, you must have been overwhelmed by the whole display. Particularly on the big feast days, of course, when the crowds would come and everything would be lit up, wonderful candles and so on. And I have a theory which I put out in the book, and I haven't had anybody who's criticised it yet, and I haven't had anybody who's come out in support, that the great windows of the Gothic cathedrals and the great height were really a means of giving a better chance of displaying your relics, particularly in the processions, and getting people round so that they could move round and actually see the relics. And the old Norman churches weren't particularly good at that. This is obviously just an idea, but it does seem to fit the dates of when we know that the relics were being put on display and the processions were becoming more important. It does link in very much with the birth of Gothic. Mm. So it's a bit far flung as a theory, but I wanted to air it because it does sort of make sense. It's the kind of thing people have forgotten now. We don't think in terms of relic cults. And one of the things about the books was I thought there is so much material here which has just not been forgotten, which has not been put together into one book. And by putting it together, at least you can then have a springboard on to further research, because obviously a lot of the book is fairly introductory level. It has to be. It goes from 380 to 1600, so it is introductory. But there's an awful lot of ideas, I think, that one could follow up in after reading through and getting the ideas from this book.
I mean, as you've just alluded to, the mise-en-scène was crucially important, wasn't it? You didn't simply acquire your artifact, your relic, and then put it in display in any old way. It was absolutely vital that you should make the most of it.
It was. You often had two feast days, and a very good example is Thomas à Becket. Thomas à Becket was murdered in December 1170. Now, the anniversary of his martyrdom, he was murdered in Canterbury Cathedral. Of course, his body. This was a real genuine relic because it wasn't made up. This was the body. They'd never let it go. So we know that people knew they were coming to a genuine relic. I mean, they thought most of the others they were coming to a genuine as well, but really, right, this is genuine. And so in December every year, there would be the anniversary of his martyrdom, and there would be a special celebration. But December is not a good time to have celebrations in medieval England or medieval Europe. And this was a European-wide cult because Thomas, of course, put forward as the figure who had stood up for the church against the state, Henry II, who had tried, you know, who had possibly initiated the idea that he should be dealt with. Probably it was a fiasco. They hadn't expected to kill him, and something went wrong, and a brawl broke out, and he gets killed. But the popes seize very quickly on the idea. Here is a martyr of the church against the state. Absolutely important to advertise this. So he's canonized very quickly, and he becomes a European-wide cult. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. You can find the most obscure parts of Italy. You can find churches to Thomas a Becket. But December's not a good date because, I mean, the roads are muddy, the channel is a bit bleak to cross, and so they thought upon the idea. The second kind of feast day you had was a translatio, and the translatio was the moment when you move the body from its original burial place to a really splendid shrine. And they created one at the back of Canterbury Cathedral behind the altar, and they affixed the date, and they weren't going to fix it in December, they fixed it in July. And the anniversary of the translatio also becomes a feast day. So they had their feast day cunningly placed in the middle of July, and they knew, therefore, that the people would be able to come in July if it wasn't as wet as it was this year. They'd be able to come from all over Europe, and as people did, and the offerings in the first decades after the martyrdom were very high indeed. They were a very substantial proportion of the total income of a rich diocese. Canterbury was a rich diocese, and I don't know exactly what percentage, but a pretty high percentage of their income came from the pilgrims.
To what extent did the church centrally have control of these cults springing up, and to what extent did it worry about them getting out of control?
Well, the early cults were very much local ones. I mean, if you look at something like Anglo-Saxon England, they're really your own local boy. I mean, Cuthbert is an excellent example. Virtually nothing, the Pope has nothing to do with it at all. He's your local, clearly saintly figure. Nobody denies he's a saintly figure, and that becomes a local cult. You really get probably about the 12th century, the popes get seriously concerned. They are beginning to be more administratively efficient, the popes. Something like Innocent III, very powerful pope, comes to the papacy at 37, tons of energy compared to some of the popes that have come much later in their lives, enormous amount of energy, and he is worried about all these local cults which spring up. People call it Saint somebody, they venerate it, and he starts putting into place a procedure. You are not allowed to be a saint until you have actually been properly canonized in Rome. And the system that they have today really goes back that far. You know, the system today, that when you have to send in miracles, you have to send in a life which actually tells why this person led such an honorable life. You must have some miracles to show that after their death, they are being operated through. God is still operating through them. And then the papacy would actually, they would have a council of cardinals who would look at the evidence, and half of them got turned down. They just said, no, sorry, not a good evidence. And what is very interesting, and it's something I just touched on in the book, is how they tried to assess whether it was a miracle or not. And then and again, the commission would be sent to the country to actually talk to England or wherever, to talk to the locals. They ruled out some miracles. They said, no, the evidence is just not good enough. No, we don't think this one. And then you had to go, they had to go through a procedure of actually deciding what made a miracle and what didn't. And then if you got a few, they would put forward, let's say, 10 miracles, and you only had to have two to get through. They'd put forward 10 to the cardinals in Rome or Avignon, when the papacy was based in Avignon, and they would go through, and then the Pope would decide. And then there would be great excitement. But it took a long time. I mean, you had to, sometimes you've got some wonderful examples of the documents being sent in with the miracles, with people from Oxford and Cambridge and the royal family and all sort of signing at the bottom, saying, yes, come on, this is the one we want, because everybody wanted to have a local saint. But very often it took 30, 40, 50 years. Sometimes the Pope just wasn't interested in a particular saint, and you had to wait until the Pope was more sympathetic to that kind of sainthood. And we have Thomas of Hereford. By the time that he was actually canonized, we know that that hardly anybody was visiting his shrine. He was so long after that, everybody had forgotten about him. It came through from Rome that he was actually a genuine saint. And at the beginning of when his body had been brought into Hereford Cathedral, at first it had been a great cult. And by the time, 50 years later, I can't remember how many years, it was something like 50 years later that he was actually canonized, the cult was almost non-existent. So the popes, of course, did want to control. It was really important that they didn't have not only just anybody becoming a Catholic saint, but having a powerful church community which could, in a way, threaten the authority of the popes. So it was really important.
And how problematic was the actual status of the relics? I don't mean their authenticity, but their theological status, what they stood for and what they could represent. And from the book, I understand that Augustine was quite a key figure in kind of establishing that.
Augustine is interesting because he starts off being very sceptical about miracles. I mean, he brought up a pagan. He converts in his 30s. He has a very traditional classical education. A lot of stress on rational thought. And when he first converts, he said, we don't need miracles anymore because we needed them at the beginning of the church just to get the things established. But now we are well established, you don't need miracles. And he's very sceptical whenever he heard about a miracle. He then somehow gets more and more fascinated by the relic cults. And by the end of his life, he's actually proclaiming that these relics really do work and the miracles really do happen. And he actually berates people for, when they have a miracle, not publicizing it. There's one example of a lady who was clear cured of breast cancer, and or supposedly cured of breast cancer, and he says, why haven't you gone around telling everybody? And I mean, this lady probably had very good reasons for her own, for not necessarily spreading around what had happened to her. He sort of intellectually gives a imprimatur, if you like, to the idea of relic cults. What is interesting is how far there is remaining skepticism. By the 14th, 15th century, people are beginning to realize an awful lot of fraud going on. So you get Chaucer writing the Pardoner's Tale. Everybody laughs at the Pardoner. He's got all kinds. He's got a bag on his back, knuckle bones of Peter, a bit of the sail of one of the boats on the Lake of Galilee. It comes in the Gospel. And everybody rather laughs at him. And quite clearly, especially when you have to pay money to get these. So skepticism does come in. And of course, it's one of the feeding streams of the Reformation, when there is actually really quite a big rejection of relic cults, and the whole idea of relics go out in the Protestant world. Some people must have realized from a fairly early time that you couldn't have two heads of John the Baptist. They couldn't both be. But it took a bit of time for people really to get that act together. And of course, there was great rivalry. I mean, if you've got the body of Mary Magdalene, there are two of them. There was great rivalry between the shrines, and one shrine won out over the other because it claimed that its Mary Magdalene had a lily on its head when the body was found, and this was it was a fresh lily, and therefore this is a sign this was the true body. So of course there were these rivalries, because particularly if the two relic cults close together, both claiming to have the same relic. So there was that kind of, you couldn't call it really skepticism, but it was really rivalry. You know, your body's fake, ours is the real one. And the likelihood that either of them had the body of Mary Magdalene sitting in Provence is very unlikely indeed. So.
And what about worries about this being paganism by the back door, this being sort of polytheistic practices, which you get, I see by the time of Luther, but were there rumblings about that before his time?
Well, I brought in the word polytheism. I've had one critic who says that this is nonsense, of course, you know, Catholicism isn't polytheistic. But I think it's really the veneration and the intense veneration of different figures in different parts of medieval Europe. So, I mean, Thomas a Becket, you've got in Canterbury, obviously. If you go to Compostela, you have James the Apostle. Enormous shrine. People are pouring in. In Rome, the big relic was the Veil of Veronica, which was meant to be the veil which Christ's face was wiped with on the way to the crucifixion. So you have these very different cults, but very important cults. In Sinai, you have St. Catherine of Alexandria. She became a great cult figure of medieval Europe. Not many people got there, of course, because you had to get to Jerusalem, which was hard enough, and then you had to go 3 weeks traveling across the desert. But still, a very powerful cult. So you can almost say that there is a sort of form of polytheism, and that these, for many people, these cults seem to have transcended what you might call a monotheistic Christianity faith based on Christ. That's why I used the word polytheism. I knew I was being a little provocative to say that. But I wanted to shock people a bit and say, yeah, if you think about it, you know, why this enormous cult, James the Apostle? I mean, you know, he's an ordinary apostle. In Spain, why should it be in Spain? And of course, then there was a legend that after the crucifixion he came and preached in Spain. Well, look at St. Mark in Venice, you know, another great cult tied in with the identity of Venice, the great trading empire. So St. Mark, his lion is seen all over the Mediterranean, wherever the Venetians are. So I think there is a sort of way in which I think if you call it polytheism, it gets people thinking about the nature of these cults and how powerful some of them were.
And you talked earlier about the miracles and the cures happening in the here and now, but the intercessive possibilities for the afterlife were also very important, weren't they? Which again makes me at least think about a sort of polytheistic, you know, pantheon.
Yes, they did. There were a lot of descriptions of the apostles and the martyrs being in heaven. And one account compares it to a court, a medieval court, where if you had a patron at the court, he would then, you possibly go and talk to the king on your behalf, or the queen, if the queen had the, depending on the power structure within the royal family. So there was this sense that all the martyrs are sitting up there and all the saints are sitting up there. And if you intercede with one, he might, I don't know how you do it in heaven, but he might pop round to Christ or a God figure or the Virgin Mary, who was, of course, a very good intercessor. I mean, it was said, you know, how can Jesus not listen to his own mother? And so, of course, that, I mean, the cults of the Virgin Mary in medieval Europe were enormous, very, very widespread. But this whole idea, yes, you might have intercession. So even today in the Catholic Hail Mary, pray for us now, we end the Hail Mary, and at the hour of our death. You know, it still lingers on. And this is one of the fascinations, of course, is how these things still linger on in the churches. So that idea of intercession, the hope that somebody would save you and intercede for you. And it comes again from Augustine, who says that really, as of original sin, none of us deserve to go to heaven anyway, because we are burdened with original sin. But the grace of God might be extended to people, and therefore the idea if you intercede with God, he might decide that to give your grace, his grace to you and save you. But it's a, you know, it's a fairly last-ditch hope. But obviously for many people, you know, you really did believe in some kind of intercession might work.
And you mentioned the Virgin Mary there. And the other interesting thing I thought was the way that the cult of relics allowed Christianity to be sort of feminized, for a female dimension to come into, not just in the Virgin, but Mary Magdalene and the female saints, which otherwise it would lack. And I was interested to see stories like that of Mary Magdalene really sort of taking off and being embroidered and developed in ways that went far beyond what the Bible provides.
Yes, I mean the women cults. I mean, the Virgin Mary becomes the most important, particularly from about the 12th, 13th century onwards. She really sort of takes over, and of course she within her femininity, there are so many different aspects that you can put forward. You can put forward the motherhood. So you pray to her for a safe birth and so on. There were girdles of the Virgin Mary that people would take when they were about to give birth, and they would put around their stomach before they gave birth. So she was the mother, she was compassionate, she had all the compassion that the more strict, rigorous views of God and Christ. And one of the most fascinating things I've discovered, and I found an actual, there are examples in Italy, is when plague struck, you would pray to the Virgin Mary, because the plague was supposed to come from Christ. And there are pictures you can actually find, there's one in Perugia, for instance, in a chapel there, where Christ is up on the top of the picture, shooting plague arrows down, And the arrows, that goes back to Homer, when the arrows, the plague is supposed to come from the gods through arrows. And the Virgin Mary is beneath them with her cloak stretched out with the arrows bouncing off. So you get this extraordinary picture of the Virgin Mary actually being the one who stops the wrath of her son reaching the earth. So that's this kind of power she had. And there's compassionate, there's femininity. There's all those sort of what you might call the feminine virtues get tied up with her. And then Mary Magdalene is the penitent. She is the sinner. It's not clear in the Gospels exactly what she'd done wrong. It was, I think, Gregory the Great, the Pope in the early 7th century, who put forward the idea she'd been a prostitute. I mean, I think there's no real record of that, but that he put forward that she was a prostitute who'd repented. So she becomes a model of penitence, and anyone who has fallen can pray to her and she will look after you. And there's a wonderful story that when she got to heaven, her virginity was reconstituted, because you couldn't be in heaven without being a virgin. I mean, it was virtually impossible for a married woman to get to heaven. So you get this extraordinary transformation of Mary Magdalene. And of course, she is then seen at the foot of the cross, often comes up in pictures of the cross, the hair down, symbol of penitence and so on. And so she becomes enormously important. And then Catherine of Alexandria becomes important. She's seen as intellectual because the legends go that she actually debated with the philosophers and completely confounded them. You know, these philosophers would be sent in, pagan philosophers, to debate with her, and she would turn their arguments upside down. So she has, she's often seen as an intellectual figure. So these women do play quite an important part in the medieval consciousness, an increasingly important part, I think, as time goes on.
As you researched the book, Charles, did you ponder what psychological dynamic was at work in the manifold accounts of statues weeping blood or things which patently we would today, with our mindset, completely reject out of hand? But again and again we have these accounts, and they can't all be fabrications.
No, it was, I think, the harder thing to do. I think when you're writing a book like this, you are dealing with a lot of stories that we could mock if we wanted to. And so you had to try and think through the psychology. And I picked up the idea from one or two studies of saints of trying to think of a mentality which is between heaven and earth. A sort of suspension of rational thought, obviously. A suspension of what you actually saw with your own eyes. But a belief that these things could happen. Now, an awful lot of it was a story picking up that somebody had seen a statue move. And it may have been for all kinds of reasons. It may have just been the light was bad. And then the story picks up. And you do get some of these statues, which there was no reason for anybody to have any particular veneration for them. But then the story gets about that somebody going into the church did see this moving. And then the story catches on. And before you know where you are, you have thousands of people coming. I mean, one of the best stories is in Prato, outside Florence, where a little boy, I think he was 8 or 10, that sort of age, he was playing around in the dust below a fresco which had the Virgin Mary and the baby Jesus on it. And he claimed that he'd seen the Virgin Mary come down from the picture, put the baby Jesus on the ground, leave him there, and then go down into the neighbouring prison and cleaned it out and came back, picked up the baby, and popped back onto the fresco. Now, this was a small boy. And the story completely was believed. And you can still go today, and you can still see, I don't know if this is the original fresco, but they painted it very soon after it. But in 1480, they built a great church on the site. It's still in full operation today with a picture of the Virgin Mary and baby Jesus on the altar. And the story lives on. So these are how these stories originated. But of course, a modern example is Bernadette of Lourdes. You know, you get these young girls who claim to have seen a vision. And the story, my goodness, if it catches on, it really does catch on. And what is the psychology that some catch on and some, I mean, we have many examples of pilgrim sites which never caught on. People tried to advertise that they had such and such, and nobody came, and you know, and they disappear. And many of them have probably never been recorded, and we do come across in the records of knowledge of some cults which we have no other record of, and they don't exist today. So some take off and some don't.
Because in addition to the spiritual dimension, there was also a clear financial dimension, wasn't there? I mean, to have a successful cult was good all round, really.
Yes. I mean, obviously, the potential for fraud was very high. There was a convent at Soissons which claimed to have the slipper of the Virgin Mary. And this opportunely appeared at some point. And the pilgrims were going to come in. And somebody came along and dared to say, well, surely she was a sort of working woman. Her slipper wouldn't be in such wonderful slipper in such perfect condition. At which point, he was struck dumb. He then had to sort of venerate the slipper, at which point his speech returned. But there is some evidence, unfortunately, it's in a very obscure magazine in study in the States, and haven't been able to track it down in this country, and it's not online. But apparently somebody's done a lot of work on this and suggests almost certainly that this was deliberately created by this convent as a cult from nowhere. And of course, it wasn't a slipper at all. And one of the things Calvin says in his famous treatise on relics, which is a critique of relics, I mean, he's a Protestant reformer, he really thinks, is that one of the problems with relics is that the relic is often of far higher quality than you would ever have known from the first century. So there are some slippers of St. Paul, the apostle, which have got all gold braid round and so on in their relic. But of course, Paul would hardly like it to go prancing around the Mediterranean in gold lace slippers, you know. And these cults do, some of them are fairly obviously, quite clearly, they would not be the original first century of a poor fisherman's or a poor carpenter's son or whatever. And they've obviously been created for all kinds of gain. And people must have actually made them known when they were making them that they were, that they were, could not be the real ones.
Well, it's like in pictorial art, isn't it? It's like in paintings from the Middle Ages or the Renaissance where biblical scenes are imagined in their contemporary dress.
Yeah, yes, that happens. A great deal, and I think this happened a certain amount with relic cults as well.
Charles Freeman. Holy Bones, Holy Dust is out now in paperback. You can find out more about it, as well as several million other titles, by going to blackwell.co.uk. There's also a podcast archive there of over 150 author interviews. Look for the podcast tab on the homepage. And the podcast is also available on iTunes. Just type Blackwell Podcast in the search box. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.